When you are hurting, when you're afraid, when you're anxious, when you're depressed, do you automatically remember that you count too? Hi, this is Dr. Cheryl Fraser, and in this episode of Sex, Love, and Elephants, there was such a warm response to last week's episode where I shared with you a Dharma talk, a Buddhist talk I gave in December on the theme of self-compassion at a three-day retreat I taught on that topic. So here we go. I'm bringing you the second night talk as well. So in this talk, you'll be asked to contemplate, do you believe you count too? What is it that moves us to care about ourselves, our relationship, kindness, and compassion? And I hope it will illuminate that kindness begins at home with ourselves. The more kindly and fairly and compassionately we can treat ourselves, which is very different from letting ourselves off the hook when we're a jerk or self-pity, as you'll hear, or anything like that. But the more we can be kind and compassionate toward ourselves, the more our heart, the more our mind can be freed up to be kinder and more compassionate to our partner, to build a better relationship, kinder to our work family, our home family, and to the world. I hope you enjoy. I'll be back with you next week. So a quote from Byron Katie. It is not your job to like me. It's mine. That's a pretty good sentence for tonight's topic of self-compassion. And I'd like to acknowledge that part of what I'm sharing with you this evening is drawn from a number of sources, some classical Buddhist texts, and from the work of the researcher Kristen Neff, who's done a great deal of research on the more westernized version of self-compassion. Beautiful work. Also Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, and a podcast host, a psychologist himself, Pema Chodron, and others. So some of the things I'll be sharing are from those sources, some from traditional sources, and some from the deep, mysterious recesses of this mind. You'll probably be able to tell which is which. So self-compassion. This is a term which some people somewhat mistakenly feel is not covered in traditional Buddha Dharma. Because the emphasis in traditional Buddha Dharma in the various traditions is often on compassion for others. Rather oversimplified and not entirely accurate, there's described to be three vehicles, three turnings of the wheel of the Buddha's teachings. The first is called the Hinayana, the Theravadin style, which is often very incorrectly characterized as we want awakening and enlightenment for ourselves, which is still a very good motivation. We want to reduce, release all suffering and become a fully awake human being. So one has to be cautious. One of the translations there is of the lesser vehicle, which is a very disrespectful and incorrect translation. But that is one of the turnings of the wheel. And then the second turning of the wheel is what's called the Mahayana tradition, where the emphasis shifts to some degree. What I'm saying is quite oversimplified right now, but to some degree to benefit for all beings, the bodhicitta, bodhisattva path, that basically, if you were able to become a fully awake person, free from all suffering, filled with wisdom, compassion, and joy, wouldn't you want to bring your friends along? And then maybe you'd feel so good you'd want to bring neutral people along you haven't met. And then maybe you'd feel so good you'd want to bring along people you didn't used to care for when you used to have greed, hatred, and delusion in your mind. And then the third turning of the wheel is the Vajrayana, the Tibetan path, which has also a very heavy emphasis on compassion and wisdom. So sometimes the idea of self-compassion gets lost, and it's sometimes incorrectly ascribed to be a modern Western construct in the last decade or so with the great researchers and clinicians that have brought it forward. And yet in the tradition of Buddha Dharma, there are deep teachings in the Visuddhimagga, which is one of the first written meditation texts with the 42 and more classical meditations that the Buddha taught when he walked the earth. There are deep messages of self-compassion through the whole teaching. So I just want to make that clear. And don't take my word for it. Take the Buddha's word for it. Here's a quote. You can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. So, let's learn a little bit more about this beautiful way of practicing. I spoke this afternoon briefly about how we understand compassion in the Buddhist sense, and also I would say in the English translation, regular sense, that compassion is different from empathy a little bit. It's different from pity quite a bit. And that the three qualities I shared with you are first that you notice the suffering of other, we'll start with. Then you're moved by the suffering, because you can notice suffering and step right over the person in the street and not be moved by it. So we need to notice the suffering, be moved by the suffering, and be moved to do something to alleviate the suffering. I talked this morning about that that's a very natural act when you're at your best. I talked about what if you were out in walking meditation today in the sleet and snow and crazy weather, and you saw a wounded kitten in the snow about to freeze to death. You'd be naturally moved, whether you consider yourself someone who likes cats or not. I can almost guarantee every single person here would be naturally moved by the suffering, be moved to do something about the suffering and pick up the little bundle of fluff and take it in to dry it off, and then maybe hand it off to someone that could take it to an animal rescue center. It's a natural impulse. But there's a lot of suffering in the world, isn't there? We can talk about the gross sufferings, what's happening in Israel and Palestine right now, what's happening in our own backyards in terms of drug addiction, abuse, domestic violence, child trafficking. There's so much horror, so much suffering. In our own little nuclear families, our own little friend group. One of my dear, dear friends, 1 week ago today, accessed the MAID program, the Medical Assistance in Dying program. He was only 63. He had stage 4 prostate cancer, and the physical pain was unbearable. So he slipped from the planet 1 week ago today. There's lots of suffering. So if we're moved by all the suffering, we'll drown, unless we're a Buddha. So this is where compassion for self becomes very important, which is the major theme I'll attempt to develop tonight, self-compassion. So it has this quality of noticing, being moved by, and being moved or having a desire to relieve or alleviate that suffering. And also qualities of understanding, acceptance, not judgment, not criticism, and so on. I'll elaborate on those in a few moments. But I have a question for you, a thought experiment, and I want you all to do this right now. I'm not going to ask you to share it out loud, mainly because you're developing some beautiful silence this retreat. But I'd like you to answer this in your mind, which is, off the top, how would you say you offer compassion or kindness to yourself? They're not the same thing, but we'll lump them for now. How would you say you currently, you know, these days, this week, these months, how do you offer compassion or kindness to yourself when you feel suffering? You're sad, you're anxious, you're going through something rough in your personal world, your work world, one of your dear friends has left the planet, etc. Think about that. Really think about it. Try to list about 10 ways you try to give yourself kindness or compassion in your book or in your head. What do you do to feel better? Is a simple way to put it. What do you do to offer yourself kindness or compassion? What self-compassion practices would you say you're practicing informally? Now, I'm going to put out a few that may have come up for some of you. You might say, I call a friend and get some support, or I eat something yummy that helps me feel better, or I distract myself, I watch a program I enjoy or play on my phone. You might say, I go pat my dog or cat. You might say, I have a nice hot bath or shower. You might say, I exercise. You might say, I journal. You might say, I smoke cigarettes. You might say, I yell and scream and hit a punching bag and then I feel better. And some of these are skillful and some of them are less skillful. Because compassion is not defined as feel better. This is very, very important. Tattoo it on your arm. Compassion is not defined as feel better. We're after the reduction and elimination of suffering, not temporary feel better. You could take a shot of tequila and maybe temporarily feel better. That's not compassion. It's idiot compassion. It's foolish. You can binge watch 5 hours of some violent, crazy television program, eat way too many potato chips, drink way too much Coca-Cola, and sugar and caffeine and salt and fat yourself into a coma. That's not compassion. It might feel like it, but that's why I want you to do this thought experiment. And I want you to take some notes tomorrow or after the retreat and really dive deep and say, okay, Cheryl, some of the times when you don't feel happy or you're struggling with anxiety, smoke cigarettes to feel better. Is that compassionate? No. In the short term, were you a cigarette smoker, would it help you feel better temporarily? Yes. Very powerful drug, does very powerful things in the brain. And generally, if you're a smoker and habituated to that, it will make you feel better for a bit. But it's not compassionate. Is watching hours and hours of violent TV and eating junk food compassionate? No. Does it feel good? Sure, usually for a while anyway. And then your tummy doesn't feel so good and you can't sleep because of all the Coca-Cola. So it's different than what I do to feel better, right? Is this a compassion practice? Is this a compassionate act? Is it in a bigger sense leading away from suffering? Now, this is a really important exploration because there are times where snuggling up on your cozy couch with a lovely blanket and a cup of tea and maybe some nummy snacks that aren't excessive or particularly bad for your biophysiology and watching a movie or something for an hour or two or three might be an act of self-compassion. What's the quality of it? What's the wholesomeness of it? Is it fulfilling? Is it soothing in a way that allows you to find center, to find equanimity, to step back forward into life? You need to find your answers, but where you may stumble is not because you're not clever, but because it's a bit of a subtle distinction at first, without deep diving, between what is actually compassionate to self and what feels good. Sometimes they overlap. Sometimes they don't. Last year, I had some excessive work stresses and a couple of really dramatic things that went on that were that quite affected me. And I found the body found very stressful. And unfortunately, the body went into quite a lot of stress and my health was not very good for the first half of this year. Thankfully, nothing chronic or life-threatening, so please don't worry. But I wasn't well. And the body just wasn't well. And I wasn't eating in a very fulfilling way in terms of health. I was eating in ways that were comforting or calmed me down. I was drinking a lot of tea. One of the things I enjoy is beautiful tea. I didn't realize I was drinking more than usual and burning my adrenals out with too much caffeine and all the things we do. So I made a choice in mid-June, and I made the choice in an hour, which was I was going to radically change what I was putting in my body. And I did. From then until now. No sugar, no dairy, no wheat, no this, no caffeine. And I feel much, 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 much better. And I'm much healthier. That was a compassionate choice, but it wasn't fun. And it didn't even make me feel good for quite a while. In fact, it made me feel worse for a while when you're detoxing from sugar and detoxing from caffeine. Felt pretty crap. But I had a bigger view, which was I want to feel better and nurture this precious human body in the way that is wholesome, I think. I'll find out from the evidence of how my body responds to this if this is a wholesome thing for this body at this time. So what's self-compassionate isn't always fun, and it doesn't always make you feel good instantly. You know what made me feel good instantly? A piece of chocolate cake. And by the way, nothing wrong with chocolate cake. I'll probably have, on occasion, a beautiful piece of chocolate cake now that I'm well. But it won't be my go-to to feel better temporarily and then have a sugar adrenal crash and feel quite awful and get a headache, right? So simple example, but one I think in your own ways you can relate to. So there's one of your homeworks for this retreat and beyond is, okay, when I'm feeling suffering, it might be mildly sad, terribly anxious, in grief, in physical pain, feeling sick, do I have practices that are compassionate? Practices that are deeply compassionate. You'll understand that better as we go through more of a definition and exploration of what self-compassion is. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about wise compassion for self and others, but we're focusing on for self tonight mostly. So it's a quality of being kind, of being understanding, changing because you care about yourself, not because you think you should or the latest blog post said you should whatever, quit sugar, doesn't mean you should, but changing because you care about yourself. Accept that you too are human. Accept that you too are human, which is another way of saying you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have challenges and difficulty. You're going to act unskillfully until you're a fully awake person, and I'm not yet. Oh, I do all those things far, far too often. A dear friend of mine called it once, I was being hard on myself, and I don't tend towards unhealthy self-criticism. I don't tend towards poor self-esteem, but I do tend toward vowing to do better when I make mistakes. But this particular time, I was kind of down on myself. It was about 15 or 20 years ago. And this person said, you know, Cheryl, we're all just bozos on the bus. We're trying to get there the best way we can. That was a really compassionate thing to say, because he was basically saying, don't be so hard on yourself. You too are human. In the Christian tradition, to err is human. To forgive is divine. So I use that phrase a great deal. We're all just bozos on the bus trying to get there the best way we can. To me, that's a beautiful expression of compassion. And when we say it to ourselves, hey, bozo, that wasn't good. I feel your chagrin. I feel your pain. Vow to do better. So it's this quality of I too am human. Wise compassion understands and accepts the Four Noble Truths that everything changes. Some of the changes will be tough. When we cling and want it to be different, we suffer. We can stop suffering if we accept what is. So acceptance, mindfulness. I'm going to expand on these in a moment. Can we open our heart to the reality of change and our imperfections? And as I said, that we're not a perfect Buddha yet. This is a wise definition of compassion. Unwholesome variation, which is more pity, self-pity in this case, but it can be pity towards others, is indulgent. It's more indulgent of the pain. It's not about nurturing ourselves while we're in pain. Oh, poor me, this is terrible. There can be a lot of complaining. There can be a lot of being immersed in our own problems, which closes us off to noticing other people. It's very selfish. So when we're going through a really rough time, we might be more or less blind to the fact that our friend is going through a really rough time. This could be quite damaging. We feel very separate and unconnected from others, which is very painful, where we're in kind of a negative, unwholesome type of self-referencing that's not the self-compassion we're talking about, more self-pity. We feel that our pain is different and unique. We forget that other people suffer too, which on the one hand can make us selfish by not noticing that someone else also lost a spouse at some point, but also make us feel very, very alone. Very, very alone. If you're going through, let's say, a breakup, a divorce, or the death of a spouse, partner, friend, etc., and we forget that others have been through this, we can feel so desperately alone. When we remember the shared humanity that others have these losses, it can be a little bit of a balm, a little bit of a softening. That's into the healthy kind of self-compassion. So-and-so lost a spouse and somehow they got through it, and in a few years they were more or less okay coexisting with that truth. There's hope for this suffering too. So hear the difference. Where we're in self-pity, stuck in ourselves. I'm not trying to be unkind. I can get there too. So it's no judgment here. It's differentiating the subtle but big difference between remembering our shared humanity, which gives us a sense of connection in our own grief or struggle, and it gives us a sense of hope in that others have suffered and are still here and maybe thriving, as opposed to being engulfed in our pain. I've been engulfed in my pain. I suspect you have as well. And it just adds more pain and suffering to the pain and suffering. So we'll go a bit deeper into this. So when we're self-indulgent with our suffering, we might, as I've said, just, you know, power eat and binge watch TV, and get these temporary hits that I was talking about, cigarettes, sugar, et cetera, sex, exercise. Some of these things can be great, but if they're just used to avoid how we feel and make ourselves feel better, we can get into a compulsive cycle, an addictive cycle. And we're afraid to face the difficult truths about us if we're being self-indulgent with our terrible pain. We may not be able or willing to look at what role, if any, did I play in this breakup? What role, if any, did I play in this work problem that led to me being fired? Am I 5% responsible, 50% responsible? You may or may not be. But when we're in self-compassion, we can look at that. When we're in self-compassion, I feel this pain from the loss of the relationship or the job. I'm frightened. There is suffering present. We can remember shared humanity. We can remember we're not the only person to have lost a love or a job. And we can then ideally have enough spaciousness around our experience because we're not also in self-pity and self-criticism. I haven't got to that one yet. Beating ourselves up. I'm a loser. It's my fault. No one could love me. No wonder I didn't keep the job. No one likes me. I'm lazy. I'm stupid. There's none of that in self-compassion. But when we're in that kind of self-criticism and self-cruelty, we may not have the, I'll use more psychological words, we may not have the emotional resilience to look at our flaws. And we've got them. Spoiler alert, you are a flawed person. You sometimes make mistakes. You sometimes do unwholesome things, sometimes purposefully, often mindlessly. If you got fired, there might be feedback in that, even if the firing is unfair. Let's say it's unfair, but there still might be feedback in that that is helpful. Maybe people find you difficult to talk to at work and you didn't know that. Maybe you tend to be arrogant or shy and be self-effacing and say, no, I didn't do anything special. And that's a little piece in what happened. We can't look at that if our esteem is weak, if our indulgence is high, if our pity is overwhelming us. We're the victim of circumstance. We're never the victim of circumstance. Unbidden, cruel, sudden circumstances can come into our life. You're smashed by a car and now you're paralyzed from the neck down. That was an unbidden, unexpected circumstance. But how we react to that circumstance is entirely up to us. When we're in self-compassion as opposed to self-indulgence or self-pity, there is a sense of wholesomeness in our choices. Not always. They're not perfect. I'm not either. But wholesomeness around the ways we nurture ourselves. And we look at our growth over the long term. This too shall pass. I'm unemployed. I'm needing to move out of my shared home because my partner doesn't want to be with me anymore. But you can see the long view, that in a week, a month, a year or two, I'll be in a very different state than I am now. And we're willing, as hard as it is, as painful as it is, as scary and as brave as it is, we're willing to gently look at what is my part in this? How can I do better? There's a personal growth guru who has a phrase I really like. I also respect his work quite a lot, but one of his big teaching phrases is, life is happening for you, not to you. Life is happening for you, not to you. I got fired. Life's happening to me. Poor me. So it's a subtle shift. Life is happening for you. How does getting fired happen for you? Maybe you don't know yet, but maybe 6 months from now when you've gone back to school in training in the thing that was always your heart's passion, or you've got a different job for less salary but much more fulfillment with a more cohesive team, you go, oh, nothing happened to me. It happened for me. For what? Well, maybe to say, okay, Cheryl, now what? Let's see what you got, kid. What you gonna do with this bag of bananas, monkey? And it puts some empowerment back in our court. Because boy, oh boy, it sure feels like life's happening to us sometimes, doesn't it? Out of the blue, or bad news, or a diagnosis that's happening to me. But what if it's happening for you? It's impermanence. It's one of the three characteristics of existence in Buddha Dharma, the truth of impermanence. I was healthy, now I have a brutal cancer diagnosis. It happens in 1 minute. It happens in that dire look on your physician's face when they say, we've got your test results. The moment before that, you don't have a terrible diagnosis. The moment after, you do. That just happened to me. What if it happened for you? Who are you going to be on your cancer journey? My friend, my partner was saying the other day, as we were talking about him, is all we can really remember when we think of this man is his laugh. He just laughed. He was full of good humor and joy and beauty and generosity and silliness. And was he perfect? No. Did he make mistakes? Yes. But this was a beautiful being. Think of people you've lost that are there and they're gone. And that particular man chose to take his cancer journey with a hell of a good attitude. Is it fair to say cancer happened for him instead of to him? I don't know. But what he chose to do with his mind, what he chose to do with his heart was to live, to be with his beautiful, blessed wife, to be with his kids, to be with his little grandkids, to travel, to see friends, to live so large until it was time to stop. There's a lot of self-compassion in that, in my view. He probably wouldn't have used those words to describe it. Or known specifically the concept, but that's how he lived. And I suppose it's how he died. He chose to access his own ending on Saturday in the manner that he wanted, to be compassionate to himself and those that loved him. So that's not self-indulgent or self-pitying. I would say it's self-compassionate. Now, we have this concept in the West, probably elsewhere, but you know, I'm much more familiar with the West, so I try to limit my statements to things I have a little more confidence in, of self-esteem. Now, I'm a psychologist by training. Most of you know that. Some of you may not. And the idea of self-esteem is fairly well woven into Western psychology, and it's certainly woven into our general culture, particularly in the last several decades. You want to have high, unshakable self-esteem, right? Well, maybe, but I'd rather you had high, unshakable self-compassion. Let me talk about some of the ways that's differentiated by some of these researchers as well. So self-esteem, which many of us may think of as kind of a good thing, I may change your mind in a moment and just shift you towards self-compassion, but self-esteem is based on a perceived sense of value or worth. And in our culture, in the North American culture anyway, it's often based on being above others or better than others or standing out from others. You know, we've got esteem because we're one of the best salespersons on our team. We've got esteem because we consider ourselves a terrific parent, better than most. Not necessarily arrogance. That sounds arrogance, but not necessarily. But we often draw a sense of esteem in this culture from how we perceive ourselves and how others perceive us, and the sense of being different, above, beyond, and more. Not average. You're not really allowed to have high self-esteem if you're merely average. Well, hang on. Anybody know what a bell curve is? 66% of people are average. And about 15% are below and about 15% are above on a bell curve. So if you got to be above normal to have esteem, you're already pretty doomed. Other issues in studies of high self-esteem and the way it's generally experienced or thought of in the Western culture is when we lose our source of esteem. Let's say you're a powerhouse at your job, you get fired, you're very wealthy, you lose everything. You have high esteem based on your parenting, how you are as a partner in the community, and something happens and your partner leaves and your kids don't want to talk to you and your community reviles you. And let's say something not fair happens. A lie about you is spread a terrible lie and it's not true, and you lose your esteem. People don't have any respect for you anymore. They leave. Your esteem might be in tatters, and often persons with high self-esteem in the Western sense, when things go really wrong, impermanence, they become depressed and anxious. So you may interpret self-esteem in a much healthier way that's more in the languaging of self-compassion. That's great. I'm not worried about the words, but I'm worried about how often esteem is experienced and built up in our culture. It's a bit more of a paper tiger. It's on a bit of a shaky foundation, right? Also, some people that have this sort of, I'm going to call it unwholesome self-esteem, get very angry and pissed off if anybody slights them or pokes at them or casts aspersion on. Well, you're not really that great of a tennis player. In the kind of wonky kind of self-esteem, you might get quite mad and say, yeah, well, come on, let's go. Let's have a game. I'll beat your ass. How strong is your esteem if you're that offended? If you've got really good sense of your skill as a tennis player without arrogance and someone says, I don't think you're that good, you say, oh, that's fine, that's a fair opinion, as you wish. Okay, and it doesn't really affect you, right? What other people think of me is none of my business, my granny used to say. It wasn't her unique phrase. I've heard it elsewhere since. But boy, I thought she was a genius when she told me that. What a great phrase. Make that one of your mantras. What other people think of me is none of my business. What I think of me, that's my business. And when I think of me in ways that I see my flaws, can I bring compassion to that? And can I say, yes, that is not a wholesome quality, and I express it or experience it too often, I vow to continue to do better and to improve. And when I display that unwholesome quality, to catch it as quickly as I can and to apologize for it and to make amends. That's esteem. Not, how dare you say I have a temper? That's not esteem. Self-compassion, on the other hand. And again, close cousins, and I don't mind if you use the word self-esteem, but build it in the way you're about to hear, because that may be where your esteem comes from. And if so, skookum. Self-compassion is not based on self-evaluation against some yardstick. I feel good about myself because I'm skinny. I feel good about myself because I got a high score on that test. I feel good about myself because I have the nicest house on the block. You can hear how shaky all of those are. Very Dharma, right? Very shaky things to have your happiness, your lack of suffering rest upon, because poof, they could go away. Self-compassion, you don't need to be special to be loved. You don't need to be wealthy or the best tennis player or excellent at what you do. You can just be you. And you know you're worthy of love and kindness exactly as you are. I quoted last night, I'll do it from memory, I may or may not get it right. It's a short phrase though. Love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart, right? And then we have W.H. Auden, the poet, the writer. And then we turned it on ourselves. Love my crooked self with all my crooked heart. That's self-compassion. We don't need to feel better than others to feel good about ourselves. We don't need to hide our flaws from ourselves, because when our esteem is a little shaky, when it's built on paper houses, paper dragons, paper tigers, when our pity is waiting, as I said earlier, it's very difficult to have the strength to actually look with compassion at your flaws, because it could cascade you into despair. I'm so stupid. I'm no good. There's got to be compassion and some space around that to be able to sit with our lack of perfection. But deep self-compassion is not based on external objects. It's based on what? Internal resilience, internal flexibility. I don't mean it has to be perfect or extra strong. Your internal resilience and your internal flexibility might get quite battered and tattered sometimes, but then apply self-compassion, which we're going to keep talking about, to help bring some peacefulness, bring some space, and bring a bit of time back to say, okay, holy smokes, I'm going through a really tough time. My sense of self is beaten up. I'm feeling like really discouraged that maybe I'm not able to get a job. This is really suffering, but I'm going to hold it, and I'm going to hold myself, and I'm going to treat myself well, and I know I'll eventually feel stronger. You don't have to be a super person to practice this. You don't have to have established it forever. I haven't. I've got a pretty darn good core of it, but at times it gets shaken. Good news. When you develop more self-compassion, research shows you have stronger emotional resilience. You can move through the difficult and tragedies of your life with a little more grace, a little more flexibility, a more accurate view of yourself, more caring relationship behavior. Interesting. With your friends, family, loved ones. That when you have a stronger self-compassion, you're often more caring in your relationships. Why might that be? Well, because when you remember you're just a bozo on the bus, and your dear friend or partner does something that seems unkind, unskillful, or worse, and you remember they're just a bozo on the bus, and when you're feeling angry and hurt by their behavior, you remember sometimes I screw up and they're probably angry and hurt at me, you can just behave much better in your relationship. All right. So one of the ways self-compassion is taught is that it has three aspects to it. So the practicing of self-compassion has three aspects to it. And in the most simple way to put it, it is kindness. It is this common humanity. And it is mindfulness. I'll repeat those. Not necessarily in that order, but you practice it in any order. But kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. So let's take a little look at each of those and their opposites. So kindness, again, if you have a dear friend, a loved one, grandchild, someone you just feel a great sense of warmth and love toward, but it's not very complex. If we think of our spouse or former spouse or our adult children or our parents, sometimes it's a little more complex. So when you think of a dear friend, grandchild, sometimes even your pet, there's a sense of kindness, right? A warmth and understanding. So when we bring that to ourselves in self-compassion practice, there's ideally a warmth and understanding. Hey, Cheryl, boy, you're really having a hard moment, right? When we suffer, when we fail at something, when we screw up, when we feel inadequate, there's a gentleness toward self, the way you might towards your dear grandchild if they messed up. Maybe they stole the jar of money that had been collected by their scout troop or their hockey team, their dance troop, and they stole it and they hid it and they got caught and they're feeling like they're a terrible person. And you might say, honey, let's talk about this. What are you feeling? I'm so bad. I'm so bad. I stole things and it's wrong to steal. Yes, honey, it is wrong to steal. And I'm glad you understand that. And it's not okay what you did. It was not a good choice. But you're not a bad person. And we all make big mistakes sometimes. And you know what makes us a good person who's willing to grow, honey? It's that we admit when we're wrong and then we fix everything we can. So can you think of some ways to fix this? Well, I gave the jar of money back. That's really good, kiddo. Really good. Can you think of any other ways? Maybe I could go and collect more money. That might be a really nice thing to do. And you know, let me tell you something. When I was about your age, I was over at my friend's house and my friend's family had so much more money than us. And I really loved my friend, but sometimes I felt kind of jealous. They had really nice things and they had this whole collection of these little cars we called matchbook cars. And they had so many, I didn't even think they'd miss one. And I took one and I put it in my backpack and I took it home. And then later my friend asked, did you see my little red matchstick car, the blah, 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 GT, blah, blah? And I said, nope. Really? Really? You stole your friend's car? Yes, I did. Do you think that makes me a terrible person? I don't know. You know, we're all human. Sometimes we all make mistakes, and what matters is what we do with it. Let me tell you what I did. And I don't know what I did because I just made all that up, but it was a pretty good example. And I don't have grandkids. But just listen to the compassion that I mimic towards this being, that they too are human. They're common humanity. But the kindness. So I bet all of you have done that and better than what I just modeled to a friend, to a loved one, even someone at work who's beating themselves up. You're like, hey, you know, you made a mistake. You filed it too late and now it's going to cost the client money, but the firm will figure it out and cover it, and you'll not do that again. And, you know, I've made mistakes too. So just remember, you already know how to do this. You just might not be very good at doing it for yourself. And some of you probably are. Some of you, as you hear this, may say, you know, actually, I believe self-compassion is quite a strength in this being. Wonderful. And if you're listening and thinking, sometimes good, sometimes bad, wonderful. If you're listening and thinking, whoa, I got some work to do, wonderful. So kindness, being gentle, accepting the reality, your lovely kid stole some money. It horrifies me and saddens me when parents are like, well, whatever, it's no big deal, I'll just pay for it. It's like, learning opportunity. Help your child move into good adulthood, goodness sakes. So the opposite of kindness is what? Blame, criticism, lack of wisdom, having a tantrum, not taking any responsibility, self-hatred, anger, guilt, shame, all of which, unfortunately, can also lead us to ignore the real pain. The real pain underneath. And if you turned that kind of energy against this fictional, wonderful grandchild who stole the scouting slash dance money, and you tantrumed at them and you told them they're rotten, you're ashamed of them, that was disgusting, I can't believe you did something so terrible. Do you understand how terrible that is? I won't ever be able to trust you again. Anybody else want to throw up right now? That's just me mimicking. But you do that to yourself, a lot of you. Maybe not in those exact words, but this abusive, critical, nasty, unforgiving, you know, stupid, 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 right? That's not compassion. That's abuse. So kindness, the quality of compassion for others and for self, is to bring kindness, non-judgment, curiosity, acceptance. That doesn't mean you're accepting that that's okay to do, but you're accepting that you did it and it wasn't okay. And you'd like to learn from it and grow and make amends and do better. So then the second part is the common humanity. We've covered that pretty well this evening, that we're not different. We all make mistakes, that I too am human, and we're all bozos on the bus is the phrase I'm using. And the wisdom of remembering that everyone suffers is very profound. I'll tell you a story. I can't remember which sutta it's from. I didn't look it up. I'm going on memory here. But this is a story of the Buddha traveling, the historical Buddha traveling, and he comes to a town and he's staying there for a time offering teachings. And in the town, there's a mother whose only child has just passed away, has just died, about 2 or 3 year old child. And so she comes to the Buddha's hut with her dead child in her arms. And she begs, oh Lord, oh please, oh master, can you bring my child back to life? Can you bring my child back to life? Can you please save my child from this death? And the Buddha, in great compassion, says, here is what I can offer to you. I want you to find from a home in the village, find a home where there has been no death. And when you find that home, please bring me a mustard seed from that home. And she says, yes, thank you, thank you. And she goes off. And of course, you can imagine what happens. She goes from home to home to home. Have you known death? Yes, my grandfather died last year. Have you known death? Yes, my wife was killed by an oxen last year, and so on. And home after home after home, until the vast compassion dawns in her that everyone loses people, including children, to death. The common humanity of realizing her pain wasn't unique, realizing the sadness of her loss is something others have borne, allowed her to bury her child, to bless her child. And as the story goes, she then joins the Buddha to study the Dharma. That's a pretty powerful story of common humanity. And it really speaks to how when we realize we're not alone in our pain, we can connect and let go a little more easily. Having personal feelings of defeat, of being angry at ourselves, being frustrated with ourselves, are part of being human. Are they fun? Heck no. Can you escape them? Not unless you drug or alcohol yourself out of existence and can't feel anything. And even then, you'll come out of that and feel it all. So no, we can't escape them. Unless we're fully awake, and I hope we all get there. In the meantime, we're going to have yucky stuff inside. How do we approach it? I mentioned this already, but I want to underline it, that when we lose sight of our common humanity, as this beautiful grieving mother in this tale did, we suffer more. We feel isolated as well. No one can possibly understand how this feels. No one has ever hurt like this. You want to hear egocentric pain being different? Listen to any brokenhearted singer sing their love song, because their heart is broken harder and worser than anyone's heart's ever been broken. Nope. We've all had broken hearts. And it's also why well-crafted love and breakup songs are so moving. We hear our shared humanity in it. Even if your lovely heart hasn't been broken in decades, you might hear someone sing about it and go, ah. Shared humanity, I feel that. I feel that pain. Been there, done that, as they say. So kindness to self, reminding ourselves of our common humanity, and mindfulness. You know all about that, right? Well, yeah, to some degree. But let's apply it here and now. So let's say, right now or tonight or tomorrow, you have some sadness arise or some agitated anxiety arise or a massive doubt attack where you think, I'm the only one who can't do this. What right do I have to even be at this retreat? I'm crazy. My mind will never do it. I'm such an idiot. Whatever type of suffering, dukkha, arises, mindfulness is as simple as you don't try to change it. You don't try to fix it. You don't try to suppress it. You don't try to ignore it. Mindfulness is to see it as it is, to be in the direct experience of whatever's happening in this moment. So this is a little squidgy, because what it means in practice is literally, if grief arises, compassionate mindfulness is to be observing the grief, attempting to not judge it, attempting to not run away from it, attempting not to shove it down and ignore it, and attempting not to indulge in it, but to witness it. We did this in the guided meditation in a different way before dinner, where I took you through something of a body scan and bringing compassion maybe to a part of the body that was uncomfortable. I didn't ask you to ignore the pain or indulge the pain or make a big story up about the pain. I asked you to witness it with mindfulness. What did it feel like? Hot, burny, throbby, gentle, dull. Witnessing with mindfulness. Mindful attention witnesses what is, and ideally, without judgment or comparison. Just this. So what would that be if right now some grief or anxiety or anger was present? It would be to sit and to breathe and to simply observe with interest the experience that is occurring. You might go into what does grief feel like in the body, the way I took you through to some degree this afternoon. A heaviness at the heart, maybe a tightness in the throat. Maybe your left ear feels funny, for real. Like observing with mindfulness, what does this feel like in the body? And then potentially bringing spaciousness. Can you imagine some space around this feeling? And so on. We can go more into that, and will, in tomorrow's teaching. But Can you bring kindness to the experience, to the Cheryl that's suffering? Can you remind yourself, I'm not the only person. This is part of being human. It sucks. But in time it will pass. And can you then sit with mindfulness when that's skillful? I work with a lot of police officers and some soldiers with complex trauma and complex PTSD. And there are times, and for us who may not have complex trauma or PTSD, and some of you in this room may well, just regular suffering, that too, it can sometimes be too much to sit with it mindfully. Sometimes that's not skillful. Part of self-compassion is knowing when it's not skillful to sit and observe this, but instead to go have a good stretch or a hot bath or to put it aside for now. We can go more into that later perhaps, but I just want to make that important caveat that I'm not saying one should always sit in mindful awareness of the suffering. Sometimes that's overwhelming and not helpful. There's a time and a place. So in mindfulness, I think I've covered most of these points, but witness the feelings as they are, ideally with openness and clarity and non-judgment. Curiosity about the experience. Direct experience of those thoughts or physical sensations, etc., without trying to change them. I'm repeating that on purpose because it's a very natural thing when something hurts is to want to fix it. It's not a dumb thing. It's quite an intelligent thing. But if we're always fixing it, we're not getting to it. And when the time is right to spend time just holding that grief with gentle compassion, maybe while tears pour down your face, not running from it, not indulging it, bringing love and kindness to the me that is grieving can help it settle out, can help it move through. I think we're close to enough for this evening. There's a few more points, but I'm going to leave them for tomorrow. But I would like to, before we sit for a few minutes, I would like to bring you a few more quotes and a poem. The marvelous Jack Kornfield says, quote, if your compassion does not include yourself, it isn't complete. So again, it's vitally important to have compassion for self. And, whoops, I found a poem today that I thought did a beautiful job of reminding us to have compassion for self. It's by someone called Anna Villalobos, and it's titled Just for Me. What if a poem were just for me? What if I were audience enough because I am? Because this person here is alive, is flesh, is conscious, has feelings, counts. What if this one person mattered not just for what she can do in the world, but because she's part of the world and has a soft and tender heart? What if that heart mattered, if kindness to this one mattered? But instead, connected to others in her sense of being distinct, of being alone, of being uniquely isolated, one piece removed from the picture, all the while vulnerable under deep under the layers of sedimentary defense. Oh, let me hide. Let me be ultimately great, ultimately shy. Remove me, then I don't have to be. But I am. Through all the antics of distinctness from others, or not really theirness, I remain. No matter what my disguises, genius, idiot, gloriousness, scum, underneath it's still just me, still here, still warm and breathing and human, with another chance to simply say, hi, and recognize my tenderness, and be just a little bit kind to this one as well, because she counts too. Beautiful. Each of you, I count too.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Sex, Love, and Elephants. But most of all, thank you for being part of this herd. If you enjoyed listening, please share this with a friend. And if you haven't already, I would love, love, love it if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show on your podcast player, because it really helps all the other elephants find us. If you have any questions or comments or maybe an idea for the show, or you'd like to be a guest, reach out to me directly at drcherylfraser.com, where you can also sign up for weekly Love Bites, science-based tips for creating love and passion that last a lifetime.